Well, good morning, everybody. If you have your Bibles, turn with me to Matthew chapter 17. We'll be in verses 24 through 27 as the anchor of our time together. If we don't know each other, my name is Andrew, and I love this opportunity to open God's Word with you. We're in the middle of this Nothing But Net series where we're looking at different times where Jesus invited people to follow him and to fish for people. And we're asking a little bit of the question, what does it look like to live in his kingdom day in and day out? And so if throughout this series, the conversations about fishing has inspired you to explore fishing maybe for the first time, it's a great time of year for that, right? It's warming up, getting ready to be spring break. And so if that's you, maybe you don't care about fishing, but regardless, you're going to get some fishing commandments today, okay? Just as we get going, I want to share a few things that will help you, one, actually catch fish, and then two, not make other people trying to catch fish mad. So here are six, I think-ish, fishing commandments. The first is this, thou shall not crowd other people, okay? Phil mentioned a few weeks ago his grandpa hooking somebody. Has anybody else here ever been hooked by a fishing hook? Yeah, the first time my ear was pierced was by a fishing hook, actually, as someone was casting it. I've gotten fish hooks in my face, in my hand. It's not a fun experience, okay? So don't crowd other people. It's also really annoying if you cast and then someone else casts over your line, and then you're like, this is the worst. Why did you come? So if you don't want people to say that, don't crowd other people. Second, thou shalt not keep illegal or unnecessary fish. So you catch a little fish, maybe you're really proud of yourself and you think, this is going to make a great meal. I hate to spoil it for you, but the tiny fish is not going to feed you, okay? Not only that, but by taking that fish, you're taking away food from bigger fish that you would want to catch in the future. You're also keeping baby fish from becoming big fish that can later become someone else's dinner, okay? So don't keep unnecessary or illegal fish. Next, thou shalt not leave behind trash or gear. Okay, so I'm not very good at fishing. I've done a lot of fishing before, but one of my least favorite things is whenever I'm reeling in, I think I've caught something really big and it ends up being your fishing line, okay? Or it ends up being the styrofoam cooler that you put in the water, and I'm assigning that to every one of you, okay? Just in that mood today. No, so don't leave trash or gear behind. Next up, thou shalt not make excessive noise or vibrations on the water. Now, I talked a lot as a kid. I probably still talk a lot in moments. And so I was told growing up that you don't talk while you're fishing, okay? I've discovered in adulthood that sound waves actually kind of bounce off the water, so it's not going to really cause a problem for you. But if you stomp in the boat, you throw rocks in the water, that kind of thing, that is going to make it harder to catch fish than it needs to be. Next up, this came from a true fisherman this week as they were giving me feedback. They said, thou shalt not spot burn, okay? That means spot burning is when someone tells you about a spot that is a great spot to fish and you go and tell everyone else about that same spot, okay? Don't do it. You're going to make somebody mad, okay? And then finally, thou shalt not ignore the weather or the tide. So the basic way to understand this is if you go to the same spot, regardless of time of year, temperature, time of day, any of that, you're going to be sorely disappointed because fish move around based upon the weather, okay? So if you want to have a good start fishing, those are some things you can begin to observe. These are things that will help remove unnecessary barriers for you doing what you set out to do when you fish, which is what? Catch fish. Thank you. It wasn't a trick question. I promise. Okay. Yeah. If you want to remove unnecessary barriers to catching fish, you can follow those commands there. And throughout this series, again, we've been talking about the call to be fishers of men. The call to seek out and bring others in our lives into a relationship with Jesus. And today we come to what is a pretty obscure story from the Gospel of Matthew. It's only found in the Gospel of Matthew. And what we're going to be forced to wrestle through is what are unnecessary barriers that maybe we put in place to doing what we are called to do in fishing for people? What are the unnecessary barriers that we may put into place in bringing people into our lives and to ultimately know Jesus? So let's go ahead and read our passage for today. This comes again, Matthew 17, verses 24 through 27. Here's what Matthew records. It says, after Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma temple tax came to Peter and asked, doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? Yes, he does, he replied. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. What do you think, Simon? He asked. From whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and taxes? From their own children or from others? From others, Peter answered. Then the children are exempt, Jesus said to him. But so that we may not cause offense, go to the lake, throw out your line, take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and for yours. Here we meet Jesus and his disciples coming into Capernaum, which was kind of a home base for his ministry when he was in this area. And apparently it was tax season in that time. And I planned this last Friday to get my tax stuff in order, and I didn't. So if you're here and you're a CPA or a tax expert, don't judge me, okay? We'll make it. April 15th, few weeks away still. We have time. But it was tax season here in Capernaum as well. And this was kind of a center for Jesus' ministry during this time. And this moment comes at a point when Jesus is spending a lot of time with his disciples explaining what it means for him to truly be the Messiah and telling them what that then means for them as well. He's refining their expectations. He's defining what it means for him to be the Messiah. And they're doing a lot of learning in this thing. And honestly, this story kind of feels like an interruption to that. So what I want us to do, just to maybe set the stage a little bit, is to look at what happens in the chapter leading up to this point, because I really do think it'll help us understand what's happening here. So if you go one chapter before this, in Matthew chapter 16, beginning in verse 13, you see that Peter declares that Jesus is the Messiah. The Messiah was the anointed one, the king that God had promised to send over previous 1,000 years plus of different promises coming together, saying that he would send one to rescue his people from sin and the effects of sin, who would come and reign as king. Now, if you'd been following Jesus for 2.5 years at this point, you'd probably be pretty excited to realize that Jesus is this coming king, right? Because this means that you're best friends with this coming king, which is good news for you. But what Jesus does immediately after this is he refines the understanding of kingship. What does it mean for him to be the Messiah? Jesus tells his disciples there in chapter 16 that it's going to include suffering and even death. Now, his disciples couldn't wrap their minds around this, so much so that Peter decides to rebuke Jesus, saying, Jesus, I know I just said you're the Messiah, but you don't understand what that means, okay? That's going to be much better than that. And Jesus responds by saying, well, not only does me being the Messiah mean suffering and death for me, it's also going to mean suffering for you. In fact, he says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. This was a hard word for his disciples to receive, because whenever they thought about the coming Messiah, they thought about the power and the privilege that would come with that, not suffering and even death maybe coming with that message. And so Jesus refines this vision of kingship. Now, before we jump back into tax season, let's see what happens when we turn the chapter to chapter 17. Chapter 17 opens up with what's called the transfiguration. Jesus is transfigured, and he again refines this picture of kingship. This idea of transfiguration is something seen in a greater beauty or a greater light than it had been before. And Matthew describes it this way in verses 2 and 3 of chapter 17. He says, there he, talking about Jesus, was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them, Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. So there are three of Jesus' disciples observing this moment. And not only do they see Jesus like this, but they see Moses and Elijah come along as well. And these are two guys that hadn't walked the earth, one of them in over 1,000 years and one in several hundred years. And so this is an incredible moment where they're seeing Jesus and maybe even Jesus' power and identity in a new way. And yet, in verse 12, Jesus reiterates again that suffering was coming his way. The disciples are having a hard time understanding how these two things go together. This power that they see as he is transfigured, this power in him being this coming king, and yet Jesus keeps talking about suffering and death. The story continues there in chapter 17, verse 13, as we see Jesus going and he drives out a demon from a young boy. And again, he refines this picture of kingship. So in the driving out of the demon, the thing we need to see there is that Jesus showed that not only did he have this kingly power here on earth, but he had power over the spiritual realm. This demon was a real evil power that was at work oppressing this boy, and Jesus drives that out. And yet, even this one who has the power to drive out demons goes on to again say that he would suffer and die and be raised to life again there in verses 22 through 23. You see, up to this point in this last chapter and a half or so, Matthew has clearly portrayed that Jesus is the promised eternal king who possesses the same power and the same characteristics of God himself. He came to seek and save the lost. He inaugurates God's kingdom. He gives us a taste of it here and now. And he says, hey, this mission includes suffering and death. Jesus brings together the ideas of power and privilege with suffering and death. And then Peter is asked about taxes, okay? Do you see what I'm saying about this passage feeling kind of random and weird? Jesus has just spent all of this time teaching, and then we see this happen here. So this story, again, that we just read in chapter 17, verses 24 through 27, you have this moment where Jesus, right after this, is returning to Capernaum. I mentioned it earlier, Capernaum was kind of a central base for him in ministry. He was probably returning to Peter's house in this area to do a ministry in this space. And we can imagine Jesus and his followers coming back, feeling like they're coming home. And then they see these collectors of the temple tax come up and they ask Peter a question, right? We see that there in verse 24. It says, as he entered the city, the collectors of the two drachma temple tax came to Peter and asked, doesn't your teacher pay the tax? Now, what is the temple tax? Well, the temple tax was not a Roman tax, okay? So this wasn't the Roman government coming in and taxing the people of Jerusalem. This was actually a tax that was paid to the temple. And it was used for the service and the upkeep of the temple. So if they're paying this tax to the temple, who would they understand them paying the tax to? To God. This was a way of paying a tax to God to do the work that God had set out for them to do. And the temple tax probably comes from a tax that pops up in Exodus chapter 30 that was known as a ransom tax. So God had rescued his people, had ransomed them from slavery in Egypt. And as they were coming into freedom, God instituted this tax that would happen for men when they turned 20 years old to recognize that God had set them free. They would give this tax for the service and use within the temple. Originally, it was probably something that was just done once a year. It wasn't sanctioned by the Roman government, but it was something understood that most faithful Jews would actually do. Again, it started out as a once-in-a-lifetime thing, but by Jesus' day, it became an annual tax that men between the ages of 20 and 50 were expected to pay. But as we look at this temple tax, it's important to recognize that the question, doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? It was a good question because there was a dispute among different Jewish groups about whether or not this should be something that you pay. So you have two mainstream Jewish groups. You have the Pharisees on one side. The Pharisees thought that in order to bring renewal among the people of God, in order to see the Messiah come, that they should tighten up the rules and regulations that were being observed among the people. And that if they could get the people to live more religious lives, then the Messiah would come and rescue them. And these are the people that were really pushing for this temple tax. The Pharisees were the ones pushing this idea that, hey, you should pay this tax every year. On the other side of mainstream Judaism in the day, you had the Sadducees. The Sadducees were a little different. They saw that what they should probably be doing in order to see renewal come in Israel is aligning with the Romans. So that they thought that this political relationship with the Roman government was going to be something really important for them to preserve and stuff. And so they were really skeptical about this new invention of this annual tax coming about. They weren't fans of it at all. So there was a little dispute there. And then you look on the fringe and you have a group like the group called the Essenes. And the Essenes were a Jewish group that were like if you want to think about who the Essenes would be, these would be the people that had like a bomb bunker and they have 30 years worth of canned goods stored up in their backyard, okay? They wanted to isolate from the rest of society. They still wanted to be faithful Jews, but they only paid this tax once in a lifetime. That's what they did in Exodus 30. And then they went back to their canned goods and practicing shooting the cans after they ate them. Okay, so that's what this group was doing. They didn't actually have guns then like that, so I don't know if they actually shot. That's not scripture. This is me just talking, okay? But the Essenes are this group that are over there. So I mention all of this to say that when Jesus is asked this question, he's being asked about a disputed matter. This isn't something that everyone saw the same way. And yet whenever he's asked the question, it's assumed that Peter would answer yes. And Peter does there in verse 25. He speaks for Jesus and says, yes, he does. Now, we don't know if Jesus overheard this conversation as they were coming into town or if he supernaturally understood what was happening because he's the Son of God after all. But when Peter gets home, Jesus speaks to him and he says, hey, do kings on earth tax their children? Or others? Do they tax their own children or do they tax others? Basically, like, is nepotism a thing or not? Okay? That's what's being asked here. And Jesus, Peter responds, well, from others. You see, because Peter knows a principle that we probably all know as well, that those closest to power often have privileges that protect them from certain obligations. This was the norm then in society, and it still is today in a lot of ways. So, for example, I've got a friend that I've gone to visit several times, and he runs an Airbnb on the side that's kind of like a tiny house in his backyard, and he rents this thing out pretty consistently. But whenever I go to visit him, guess what? He blocks out those days, and I get to stay in the tiny house Airbnb for free. Why? Because I have a special relationship and special access to this person, so I don't have to pay the same price that you all would if you wanted to go to Effingham, Illinois, and stay in an Airbnb, okay? Tiny house Airbnb, I can't help you. I have the relationship you don't, okay? This is how it works. When you're connected to the ones in power, there may be special privileges that come with that. Well, Jesus acknowledges this and he says, well, if this is true, then the children are exempt. Now, if we remember what happened earlier here in chapter 17, verse 5, we saw Jesus was transfigured, and then there was a voice from the cloud that said, this is my son whom I love. In him, I am well pleased. Listen to him. So three of Jesus' disciples just heard that Jesus' identity as the Son of God was affirmed. So this temple tax is something that Jesus should be exempt from. Not only that, but in Matthew chapter 12, verses 48 through 50, we see that Jesus teaches that those who choose to follow him are, in fact, also his brothers and sisters, his mother, that sort of thing. These are people that have special relationship with him. So Jesus and his disciples should be exempt from the tax. And yet, what does Jesus say? He says, but so that we may not cause offense, throw your line in the water. This is one of the few instances in scripture where this is his idea of throwing a hook in the water attached to a line. And the first fish you catch, it'll have this coin in your mouth. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours. I think the core here is this idea of this offense that they were to avoid. You see, this word offense is the word that we get our English word scandal from. It can also be translated as stumbling block if it's presented in a different form. We'll see that here in just a minute. But why is it that Jesus gives this answer about not offering offense? I think it's because Jesus knows his mission. He is the Messiah, and he came to inaugurate God's kingdom. He came to seek and save the lost. He came to draw all people to himself. And the people who were collecting this tax, the collectors of this temple tax, were some of the people that he came to seek and to save. These are some of the people that he came to draw to himself. And it seems like refusing to pay this temple tax would have caused an unnecessary barrier if they found out that Jesus did this because he was God's son. This would have caused an unnecessary barrier to them responding to Jesus as Messiah if he would have taken advantage of his privilege here. So Jesus instructs Peter to pay the tax and highlights how God would provide for them in this moment. See, Jesus makes clear that the conversation around temple tax was not a gospel issue. It wasn't a core issue significant enough for Jesus to take a stand on, especially if it caused others to reject him over something minor. You see, followers of Jesus must pay attention to how they live to keep the mission as primary, not their own privilege or power. This is what it looks like to live and love like Jesus. Just like whenever we go fishing, there are things we can do to ensure we're not creating unnecessary barriers to catching fish. So we must make sure that we are not doing the same when we join Jesus on his mission. So think about your own life. Are there things that you make a really big deal that cause others in your life who are maybe different than you to respond to Jesus negatively? Are there things that you do that cause unnecessary offense? Now, to explore this a little bit, I want us to maybe think about a couple areas in our life. And because we want to play things safe here, we'll talk about politics, we'll talk about church preferences, and we will also talk about just everyday life stuff. Sound safe enough for today? Can we live there for a minute? Okay, so if we think about this politically, a question you may ask is whenever somebody is wondering what you think or how you will respond to something in the world, do they think first and foremost about your political affiliation, or do they think about you as a follower of Jesus? Which would be a safer indicator for them to understand how you would respond? Do they think that you see a difference? What about the way that you talk about other Christians who believe different than you? Does that reflect something that looks like you understand what Jesus is saying here, that you need to keep the primary things primary, or does it seem like you might be slipping somewhere else? You see, if we're thinking about this political realm, I was helped by a resource called the Pour Over. They have a news cleanse that they send out on Sunday, and last week they asked the question, is your consumption of news making you more curious or more combative? You see, as followers of Jesus, if we're thinking about the political space, if we're thinking about how we take news in, we have to wrestle with those questions. Is the way that we consume this and live as political people with our political affiliation, is it creating unnecessary barriers over things that are not sin issues to people actually coming to know and see Jesus? If it is, Jesus says, hey, you may have the right and privilege of doing that, but cut it out. It's not worth causing unnecessary offense. Whenever we think about church preferences, the question is like, what do you feel maybe entitled to? How is it that you talk about other Christians or your music preferences or your preferences with programs or whatever it may be? Is the way that you talk about those things in front of other people who don't yet know Jesus, does it cause them to be drawn to Jesus or to say, if that's how you talk about other Christians, I don't want anything to do with that? Now, I bring this up here, and I'm not saying that this is a you problem. As a staff member, I have my own preferences as well, right? There are things where I can be just as guilty of this as anybody. The same thing's true for our elders. The same thing is true for each of us. We must pay attention to the things that maybe we feel entitled to or the things that we have that are preferences that are not gospel issues. We need to make sure that we're not allowing those to get in the way of other people coming to know Jesus just because we like things a certain way. How about in your own life, in everyday life? Are there ways that you take advantage of benefits at work or benefits in your neighborhood or as a customer whenever you go out somewhere that cause unnecessary offense to people coming to know Jesus? Are you a coworker that maybe causes other people to say, whatever you do, please do not put me on a group project with that person? I do not want to work on a project with them. I do not want my reputation tied to them. They're going to take advantage of every shortcut they can, or they're not going to do their part. They're just going to do the bare minimum. That is causing unnecessary offense to people seeing and knowing Jesus. We have to pay attention to these things that may not be overtly sinful and yet create unnecessary barriers. Are we okay? We good? We can keep going? Okay, great. So, thou shalt not create unnecessary barriers around secondary issues. Now, I want to make something else clear. Do you know that there are times in Jesus' life and ministry where he did cause offense? So this isn't saying that there's never a time that anyone should ever be offended, and if you ever cause offense, that you should then go shrink up in a corner somewhere. No, that's not what's being said here. But what is being said is that the church is probably more so for causing offense over silly things than we are true gospel things. So if you look in Jesus' life and you look at a section like Matthew chapter 13, there's a moment where Jesus goes to his hometown and he's doing these things that's showing that he is this Messiah that was promised to be sent. And those that grew up with him see the way he's living and stuff, and they're like, that's Mary's boy. And they take offense to who Jesus is as the Messiah, and they won't receive him. Matthew chapter 15, verse 12, Jesus' disciples are observing an interaction between Jesus and the Pharisees. And they come to Jesus and they say, don't you realize that you just offended the Pharisees in this moment? But you know what was happening in that moment? The Pharisees were taking the tradition of their forefathers and putting that above God's command to actually care for their parents in that section. So they were taking the tradition of man and putting it above the law of God. And Jesus caused offense by highlighting that. And Jesus was okay with that. But what we need to pay attention to are the things in our life that cause unnecessary barriers to other people, unnecessary offense around things. The gospel is offensive enough. Let's not add to it. Now, as I was reading this passage and trying to figure out how it fit into the broader context, I was struck by what happens immediately after this moment. You see, from here, Jesus moves from talking about secondary things that maybe cause offense to others to actually causing sin in other people's life and things called stumbling blocks. And the thing you need to know is that the word for offense is the exact same word that's translated as stumbling blocks in this next passage, just in a different tense. He says that you need to pay attention to the stumbling blocks that God's people can put in the way of people coming to know Jesus or continue to trust him. In a weird way, again, Jesus has been talking about this refined vision of kingship and how it's going to mean suffering and death. But if you open up chapter 18, verse 1, you see the disciples immediately ask the question, okay, Jesus, we get suffering and death stuff. We get, you know, have to take up your cross, all of this. But who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Like, that's what we really want to know. Like, who's going to be the greatest? And Jesus says, hey, unless you come to me like a little child, unless you come humbly, you won't receive the kingdom. And he talks about not only responding to him humbly, but also humbly receiving others who would come to him as well. And then he offers a warning to those who wouldn't receive these ones who are coming as little children, but would instead cause stumbling. Here's what he says in verse 6. It says, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of these things that cause people to stumble. Such things must come, but woe to the person through whom they come. You see, in addition to secondary issues that cause offense, we also need to pay attention to the things in our lives that could actually cause others to sin, and in doing so, cause others to reject Jesus. Just so that we can play it safe again, let's talk about politics, church, and the world. So, politically, is the way that we engage with our political affiliation causing us to talk about or speak about people created in God's image as if they were less than that? Is the way that we're engaging and talking about people who believe different than us, is it causing us to affirm the dignity and worth that people have, not because we give it to them, but because they're created in God's image? Or are we taking advantage of some sort of freedom to tear other people down because they don't think like us, look like us, or believe like us? See, we have to wrestle with that question. Because too often, the way that the church talk about people that disagree with them, it causes other people to sin and actually stumble in coming to know Jesus because we commit sin in tearing other people down and treating them as less than human. We have to pay attention to that, or else we may be doing what Jesus is warning against here. In the church, you see a global reckoning happening over the way that this has happened. In the way that the church has covered up some sexual sin over the last little while that you've seen across the global church, or you see the way that the church has misused power and the dynamics that are happening there, you're seeing these things come to light because what has happened is the church has responded sometimes in a way where they say, let's control these things and keep them in the dark, and Jesus is now bringing those things to light. And if we stumble into the spot where we try to push those things into the dark, you know what we're doing?
We're causing other people to stumble. We're causing other people to actually turn away and reject Jesus. When we think about the workplace, neighborhood, and world, you have to ask the question, are there ways in which you are living or working that is causing other people to sin? So if you lead a team, is the way you talk about the work that you are doing, is the way that you encourage other people to work, is it encouraging them to find their identity in their work and in their production? Are you encouraging people to fall in love with money and be controlled by the bottom line instead of some greater mission or value? How is it that we are engaging? If we press into these types of things, we can actually cause people to step into sin and ultimately to reject Jesus. Immediately after this, Jesus talks about a third layer. Maybe it's not causing other people to sin. Maybe there is sin in your own life causing you to stumble. Jesus says, hey, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. This all happens here in this one passage. Again, this connection between offense and this causing of stumbling must not be missed. Jesus does not take these things lightly because they result in the rejection of Jesus and the way of Jesus. Jesus makes clear that his followers must pay attention to how they live to keep the mission as primary, not their own privilege or power or preference or their sinful pleasures. Jesus makes this tie to mission even more clear in what follows. In verses 11 through 14, he talks about how if a man owns 100 sheep, would he not leave the 99 on the hills to go and find one if they wander off? And if he finds it, is he not happier about the one sheep than about the 99 who wander off? Jesus says this in verse 14 of chapter 18. He says, in the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should perish. So why do we pay attention to things that cause offense or cause stumbling unnecessarily or actually are causing us to stumble? Because these are things that could cause one of these little ones to perish. You see, the call to pay attention to what might cause offense or stumbling for someone coming to know Jesus is tied to the fact that your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should perish. So if we are a follower of Jesus, if we are a child of God, what are the things we can take from this? I want to highlight three things. One is this. Your identity as a child of the King comes with privileges, okay? Don't undersell that. You've been united with Jesus. You reign with him. You are invited on mission with Jesus. You have access to the Father at any point because you're awesome? No, because of Jesus. This is something that you have that is true, and you should not feel bad about that privilege that you have in light of your special relationship with Jesus. But second, your identity as a child of the King frees you from being bound to, clinging to, or being controlled by a privilege that you have in life. See, you have freedoms that have been given to you in coming to Jesus. But Jesus warns us against being controlled by those privileges or those freedoms. If you're controlled by those things, you'll miss out on what it is that God has for you. Maybe even create, again, those unnecessary barriers or stumbling blocks. I think about Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 11, where Paul writes this, that we should have the same mind that is ours in Christ Jesus, who, being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, something to cling onto. So even though Jesus is in nature God, he didn't cling on to that thing. Instead, he made himself nothing, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. He laid aside what was rightfully his in order to come and rescue those who could not rescue themselves. And he invites us to do the same thing, to not be controlled by those freedoms, but to be willing to set them aside. And so as a child of the King, we must ask the question when we're faced with decisions, how might this impact others? We must be willing to lay down privilege and authority for the sake of others. You see, if we want to be fishers of men, then we must understand the things that would actually keep us from the catch. Rather than focusing on privilege or pleasures, pursue the one at great cost and celebrate. For in the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that one of the least of these should perish. If you're here today
And maybe you don't know what you think about Jesus. One of the things that I want you to see in this story today is that Jesus came running after you. And he makes a way for you to come to him. And it's not by you getting all your stuff together, but it's by you actually humbly coming as a child and being honest about maybe sin that you have in your life that you haven't been able to get rid of because you can't on your own. To come and own the fact that you can't make yourself clean, you can't make yourself good enough for him, but to humbly receive him and respond to him. He would love nothing more. Not only does he do that, but he calls his church to run after people in the same way. And so I would just say this, we recognize that our church and the church in general has not done this always perfectly or even well. And yet, what we're saying is that God is so committed to this, that he challenges us in and through his word to keep this in front of us. That we must take seriously Jesus' challenge and commit to pursuing this call to lay down our own privileges for the sake of others coming to know Jesus. And so what we're gonna do as we wrap things up is I'm just gonna give you 2 minutes to reflect on 3 prompts. The first is this, to ask God, are there any unnecessary barriers in your life that are making it harder for other people to come to know Jesus than it should? So again, this can be non-sinful things that are causing offense. This could also be ways that you're causing others to sin, or it could be sin in your own life. Second, I'd encourage you to just spend even 20 seconds reflecting on that verse there to see God's heart not only for you, but for others in your life. And finally, sit with that question of what's one step you can take this week to remove unnecessary barriers. So I'll give you a little bit of time, then I'll come back up. So if you're here today and you want to have a conversation about what it looks like to follow Jesus, we'd love to do that. If you have something that you would like to pray about, please meet us up front right after service. If you're here and you want to talk about a next step in getting more connected, please stop by the Connection Center on the way out. A church family, we have the honor and privilege of running after Jesus together and seeing more and more people coming to know him like Camila today. So let's have a great week. Live and love like Jesus.